Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Professor Andrew McGettrick, preeminent educator and scientist. Andrew shares his views on education and the broader computing challenges. Andrew, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Thank you for asking me, Stephen. It's a privilege to be asked to be involved, and I'm looking forward to our chat.
Andrew, you're quite a remarkable individual, and you've made so many contributions to the world and to education and to society and to the different communities that you're involved with. You know, I'm really curious, can you profile your background and what triggered your interest in computing?
Well, going back a number of years, I trained initially as a mathematician, and all my early studies were in mathematics. When I was doing my PhD in mathematics in Cambridge, or arithmetic as it was called in those days, I got involved in using computer as a kind of laboratory. I could then do calculations quickly, and that helped me, of course, with my studies. And thereafter, I came to the computer science department at Strathclyde here in Glasgow, which is my hometown. Over the years, I've spent short spells in Bell Labs at Murray Hill and Cambridge and Canberra, but the vast bulk of my life has been spent here in the computing department at Strathclyde. The department, incidentally, is now a department of computer and information sciences, which suggests the way in which evolution has happened. Strathclyde itself is a technological university with around 15,000 students. It has a motto about being a place of useful learning, and that's been an important guiding influence on me. I got pulled into the world of computing education by being asked to head up the quality assessment of all the computing departments in Scotland, and then being asked to chair a panel that undertook the benchmarking of computing courses for the UK at undergraduate level, and then later in a separate activity at postgraduate level. So that kind of gives an overview of how I got where I am at the moment.
Well, as I mentioned, a remarkable background with so many contributions. Now, in your prior roles, what were the three most difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time, and what would you do differently now?
Well, at Strathclyde, I was head of department on and off for a period of about 14 years. Over that period, we had, you know, good times and less good times. The department grew from relatively humble beginnings to one of the largest departments in the university. And in the past, I would love to have created a computing college, or as we would call it here, a computing faculty, really to advertise to the outside world that the university saw computing at the same level of importance as, let's say, science, engineering, business, education, and so on. But although we got the department to a reasonable size and so on, we never quite got there in terms of the ambition of having a computing college or a computing faculty. So that's one of the challenges that I wasn't able to overcome. As a second challenge, I would like to have been able to foster a more positive image of computing as a discipline and so on. We did suffer from the downturn in student applications that many institutions have suffered, and we're now back to a relatively positive situation. But still, there is something there that needs to be addressed and needs to be looked at. On the third point, then, on the technical research side, a number of years ago I was involved in a large European project whose purpose was to create an environment for what was called at the time transformational programming. It was a kind of new kind of programming, and it held all sorts of promise. I got quite excited by all of that and saw great possibilities to explore new ways of programming, to gather intelligence about creating programs, about links between programs and the formal side of it, namely proof and so on. But all of that depended on getting a sort of working system, and although parts of the system worked and we made progress in many areas, then the whole system never did quite work in its entirety, and so that was something of a disappointment. In terms of what I would do differently, then there's not much that I would really change. You do your best at the time and you then live with it. I've never really sort of looked back with regrets, but I've always tried to look forward and to be positive. Of course, it would be true to say that over time your views change, and in this business, of course, lots of the changes are caused by technological developments, and that conditions your views and changes your views about the way ahead. But to address your question more directly, certainly in the current climate, I would now present computing in a different light, and I expect that as we go on, I will say more about that. On the transformational programming front, then, perhaps we ought to have taken a more evolutionary approach to the development of our system, and perhaps that lies behind some of the disappointments. On a more general level, looking at my background, I guess if I had to relive it, I would try to become more involved in the US computing education scene at a slightly earlier stage, but there we have it.
Well, thank you for sharing those profiles from your, you know, very long history, and you know, very much appreciated. So what were some of the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
Well, disruptive forces, of course, are not always bad. If I had to look at the key disruptive forces, then I would certainly say that, you know, having a family and so on is a disruptive force. But what that forces you to do, of course, is to think about their education, and that is very important. That's taught me a lot. In particular, it taught me that every single student is different, and every single student has different needs and different aspirations and so on. And they therefore have to be treated differently and treated in a very personal kind of way. That disruptive force has also caused me to ask questions such as, you know, do I think differently about my children and the students? And at one level there, the answer has got to be, yes, I do. At another level, of course, the answer is, no, I shouldn't. And certainly when I'm giving advice, I ought to be treating students in much the same way as I would treat the family, at least for certain kinds of advice. So having a family is a disruptive force, but a force for good overall, and certainly no regrets there of any kind. I guess in our area also, technological developments are certainly disruptive. These technological developments in computing cause you to reflect on what you teach, tends to change your views about many things, including how you teach and even what constitutes good work and so on. So technological developments have certainly been a major disruptive force, but again, a force for good rather than anything else. In terms of some of my other activities, I get involved in a lot of editing of textbooks, you know, like hundreds of them. And again, that can be disruptive. You get proposals coming in from all walks of life, from all corners of the earth and so on, and you get people presenting different views, and that causes you to reflect a lot on their worth. And normally they're very interesting and cause you to change your views and so on. So again, disruptive, but healthy and inspiring normally, and good.
In all of your current roles, what are the biggest challenges and their solutions?
Well, in my current role as chair of ACM's Education Board, my biggest challenge there is pushing ahead with computing education agenda at all level of ACM's Education Board and Education Council. So there I need to address the major challenges of the day and then ask, how do we solve those challenges? Bearing in mind, of course, that the membership of committees and councils and so on is expert but volunteer. And generally that activity is about, you know, giving advice and guidance to a huge international community. And when you give that advice and guidance, then it's important that you have evidence to support any view that you put forward. So that's a challenge. One of the major challenges actually are the pace of technological developments, and the fact that some of these current developments, such as multi-core computing, are actually threatening the way we do business. And by that I mean the way we program, the way we develop software and so on. And of course, multi-core is the future. So the challenge at the moment is, how can we give advice that needs to have some permanence about it and needs to have wisdom behind it and so on. And that's a major challenge, and I'm not sure of the answer to that. It's something I struggle with on a day-to-day basis. As someone involved in educating students of computing again, we need to change all aspects of that process. We need to change what we teach. We need to change how we teach it. We've got to strive to ensure that students develop a good work ethic. One aspect of that is providing good work, of course, but it's work that they are proud of and that they find value in, and that is difficult. In doing all of this, we need to, of course, convey something about our own passion for the discipline, as well as something about the beauty and the elegance of the discipline. Of course, each person will interpret that differently and have a different perspective as what it is that they seek to identify as elegance or passion or whatever. So all of that's a substantial challenge, because now it's almost true to say that information is available anywhere at any time, and so we do not just wish to impart information to students, but we have to look at deeper issues and deeper perspectives of what it is we're trying to tell the students. So pointing out to them, you know, directions for rich resources, encouraging them in innovation or creativity, etc., is one way ahead, and the way ahead that I think holds most promise. But all of that is hard, and all of that takes a lot of time. In trying to look at the way ahead, we need to, of course, keep striving for solutions, and that means having close links with the right kind of industry. It means having links with the right parts of the research community. In all of these tasks, I'm very lucky with the colleagues I've got on the Education Board and the Education Council. But having said that, it would be good to see a lot more young people coming through and taking a serious interest in computing and computing education, because young people really have to be part of the future, and they can relate much better to young people than some of the older folks. On a separate front, in terms of challenges, I'm involved as one of the vice presidents of the British Computer Society, and at that level I've just been handed the task of pulling together a new engineering and science board. And essentially that's a challenge, that how do we support engineering and science within the society? And part of that is how do we move the society in a meaningful way closer to the engineering and science community, or if you prefer, moving the engineering and science community closer to the society. But that's a challenge, and it's a new challenge, so watch this space.
You know, what I'm really struck with is, you know, with all the activities that you're involved with, I mean, you must be working an 80-hour week. So how do you manage those time challenges?
The difficulty, I think, is the answer to that. I think once you get involved with this kind of area, you tend to be just thinking all the time about the challenges and about the solutions and so on. And it just becomes part of your life, so you tend not to see it as, you know, a stress or a strain. It's just the way you live kind of thing, you know.
Well, you definitely are very engaged in making all of these contributions, and, you know, all of us are very thankful for that. What do you see as the role of informatics education in the 21st century?
I think that's an interesting question, and I think one of the things we need to do is to be telling a different story, really, about what computing is all about. And incidentally, I like the term informatics because it conveys a stronger role for information in what we do. And as I said earlier, our department at Strathclyde now is a Department of Computer and Information Sciences. It's a title that's a bit lengthy, but it's about what it conveys rather than anything else. Over the last 50 years, of course, if you look at the developments in computing then, things have changed, and they've changed quite dramatically, and I think the story about what computing is all about needs to be rethought, and if needed, we should change that story, and I think we do need to change it. So, as I mentioned earlier again, nowadays it's almost true to say that information is readily available anywhere, anytime, any place. And one way of interpreting that is to see it as augmenting the capacity of an individual. All of a sudden, the information is there and available, and every individual has access to that. And of course, you can develop that theme a little bit and talk about individuals more easily building up expertise in particular areas, more easily getting information about any topic and so on. If you think also of the computational power of the computer, then of course what that does is it enhances the ability of the individual to perform calculations quickly. And again, that can be seen as another dimension of this business of enhancing human capability or human capacity. And if we move on in a similar vein, then you can start to use the computer to model or to simulate and so on. And of course, what that does is enhances the ability of the individual to undertake decision making, to undertake design, if you think of modeling of bridges and modeling of traffic and so on. It enhances abilities for entertainment, of course. It enhances abilities for education and enhances things in all sorts of ways. And when you put that all together, then you can say that, you know, computing and informatics is really about enhancing the capability and the capacity of the individual, extending their horizons, extending their abilities, making them more effective as individuals in all sorts of ways. And of course, that's true, but it's true only if individuals have a disciplined approach and an educated approach to the way in which they use computers and the information that they make available. And for me, informatics education now is about just that. It's about how you extend human capability and human capacity, and how you do that in a way that's disciplined and effective.
How can we heighten the status of computing education?
Well, there are various approaches to that, and we've recently adopted a number of these approaches within the ACM. So, for example, one of the things we've done relatively recently is create a number of journals, and those journals are deemed to have a status that's similar to those of the more traditional computing journals. And of course, through the refereeing process and the publication process, then one of the things you can do is set standards and thereby enhance status and enhance the whole status of the community. Additionally, we've created awards of Distinguished Educator. And again, Distinguished Educator is seen to be of similar status to Distinguished Engineer or to Distinguished Scientist and so on. So again, that's one way of heightening status of those involved in computing education. Of course, there's also prizes at various levels, and these prizes are marks of distinction, and some of these prizes are really worth having and so on. So they're important, and of course, what they do is they encourage excellence. Of course, the story that I was telling earlier about, you know, new interpretations of what computing education is all about is kind of part of that, because it's about developing a deeper understanding, really, of the true value and the fundamental importance of informatics education. But of course, to heighten status, we need to convince other colleagues that this view is the right one, it's a valid one, it's an important one. We need to then convince educators to adopt it. We need to convince parents to sympathize with it, and so on. So there's a kind of a marketing issue then that underpins the adoption of the view that I was trying to promote. And all of this is about changing views. It's about changing attitudes. And of course, we all know that change on that scale is something that is not easily accomplished.
You know, earlier you mentioned the ACM, so that's the Association for Computing Machinery.
That's correct, and it's one of the major professional bodies for computing within the U.S. It's often the A is interpreted as America, but as you say, it's the Association for Computing Machinery, and it sees itself as an international organization, and that international dimension to it is something that is important, and it's stressed at every meeting of the ACM's council.
Now, your current president is Dame Wendy Hall, and she's also based out of the UK. So, again, indicating the international element. Have you just set up a European council?
That's right. There's an ACM Europe council that has just been set up. There's also ACM India that's been set up, and an ACM China that's been set up. So the intention of setting up these, not separate organizations, but these separate councils, is really for ACM to advertise the fact, for example, that in Europe it's keen to promote activities that have got a European flavour to them, are run by Europeans for Europeans. And I think within Europe, then ACM has something like 15,000 members, and those in, at the top in ACM feel it's rather important that they should respond to the needs of those members and support them.
And Dame Wendy is the first, I guess, non-North American president of ACM. So
that's correct. That's correct. I mean, there were previous presidents who have come from the UK. I mean, Steve Borden, for example, came from Cambridge, but is now living in the US and was a prior president of ACM. But Wendy is the first ACM president who lives in the UK and has lived outside of America.
Now, we've already touched on this somewhat earlier, but can you expand further on the challenges in computing education?
So as indicated, you know, earlier, it's about this business. I see it as largely about this business of extending human capability and human capacity and so on. But, you know, at some level, that's kind of too general and too simplistic a statement to make. At a more practical level, if you want to really make a change, then education has got to be conducted in a context that's meaningful to the audience. And for us, then normally the audience is the young, and that audience tends to be highly diverse, includes males, females, ethnic minorities. And the education has got to appeal to all of them and has got to be relevant to all of them. So if we really believe that, what I've said is the way ahead, then what we need to understand is what aspects of computing or informatics do we introduce at particular stages of development, when they're 5, when they're 7, when they're 10, when they're 15, and also what are the contexts that then appeal to them, to the males and the females alike, to ethnic minorities, to folk with differing interests, and so on. And I think there's a lot of scope for deep insight, for experimentation in that whole area, really to understand what it is we ought to be doing at particular stages.
So I'm sort of curious then, do you see your work and others kind of tying into this whole idea of computational thinking? And can you maybe define computational thinking or computational concepts? And because in the audience, there's people who are not necessarily in education.
Well, computational thinking is a phrase that was introduced a number of years ago, and it's certainly, you know, a topical phrase. It's spoken about often nowadays in meetings, and almost one of the big contributions of the phrase computational thinking actually is to stimulate discussion about what it means and how to properly interpret it. I think those who coined the phrase had in mind the notion that, you know, in other disciplines, in physics and chemistry and biology and maths and this, that and the other, then there are ways of thinking that come from computing and are relevant in these other disciplines. So computational thinking tends to be a phrase that captures those aspects of thinking and education in informatics or computing that then have relevance in all sorts of other disciplines and in other walks of life. And of course, if you're talking about enhancing human ability to think or human capacity, then you would certainly hope that that would apply in other disciplines as well.
And I guess there's sort of this attempt, I see it in the U.S. and in other countries, to put some of these ideas of computational thinking into, you know, grade school or what we call K-12. So it's introduced very, very early. And that there's some positive aspects of doing that and you know, addressing then, you know, there was shrinking enrollments for a number of years, and to address those kind of concerns.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the major developments in the U.S. at the moment, and I was going to say something about this in a few minutes, but it is to do with the advanced placement course, the AP course, that's been developed in the U.S., and that is to a large extent about computing at high school, especially at the age of, you know, transition from high school into university. And there are new developments that are happening there. The developments are important developments that have their basis in terms of computational thinking. And what they are aiming to do is to create a different kind of computing course, a computing course that will be seen as relevant to, you know, the vast majority of students, and that if they take that course, then they can move into higher education with a background that means they can apply that computational thinking in all sorts of other disciplines and in other ways. But that course is at the stage of development at the moment, and it's something that I'm keen to keep an eye on and keen to see how it develops. But computational thinking is fundamental in there, and it's at the back of a lot of that.
You know, there's a discussion I've been having with some computer scientists, and some of them feel that perhaps there's some confusion because there's so much segmentation of the computing area, you know, whether it's information science, information technology, you know, computing systems, software engineering, computing engineering, and, you know, kind of list goes on. Do you see that sort of a fragmentation occurring, and is there some sort of clarity that's going to happen in this whole computing space?
Well, I think part of the whole development of computing is actually to see all these sort of, you know, sub areas that are developing. And you can go further to look at courses in, you know, artificial intelligence and human-computer interaction and mobility and so on and so forth. So a lot happening, and part of that is just the explosion of computing itself as a discipline, and also the application areas into which, you know, computing is actually relevant. You're right when you say that, you know, part of what that is doing is creating an element of confusion, but certainly at the level of, let's say, high school and first year, I think it's unfair to expose students or their parents to that level of confusion. And so I would like to see a sort of distillation of key ideas, and let those key ideas be the sort of fundamental, you know, part of education through school, through high school, even to the level of sort of first year in higher education. And then once, you know, students start to see and understand what those various differences are, let them then choose and decide which way to go. You don't want to make a choice at too early a stage, because if you do that, then you're going to force them down a path that maybe they'll regret at some stage, and it's not fair to do that. There should be the opportunity for having a look over the wall at what there is, and then making a decision about which way to go. So I see that fragmentation as maybe being relevant in higher education, but at the more advanced levels of education rather than at the stage of transition from high school into education. When we were doing the sort of benchmarking of computing courses in the UK, one of the things we had to do was to come up with a benchmark statement that sort of characterized computing. And of course, what you couldn't do is come up with something that would cause all the institutions in the country to change what they were doing and so on. So you had to distill ideas and distill the sort of essential character of what computing was all about and try and capture that. But part of that process led us to look at the number of degree courses that there were in computing, the number of undergraduate degree courses. And bearing in mind that, you know, in the UK, the title of a course is often used for marketing purposes, then many institutions will have quite a number of courses that are then used to sort of market the kind of expertise that exists within the institution. And in fact, there was over 6,000 courses actually that were offered in the UK alone. And that is a level of confusion that is just ridiculous actually. So it points more firmly then back to what I was saying about, you know, taking students onto computing courses and teaching them some fundamentals and essentials earlier on, but then allow them to specialize thereafter, but specialize only when they understand what route they want to take and what direction they want their careers to go in.
So I guess that leads to this question then, in the K-12 space where many of the attitudes are set, and that's going to determine then enrollments into post-secondary, What do you think about the Alice environments or the Scratch computing environments for both the teaching and learning about computing?
Yes, I mean, I think they are attractive. I mean, they offer the sort of, you know, graphical user interfaces and so on. And I mean, it's difficult to give you a sort of general answer to that. It's kind of like horses for courses, as it were, that, you know, some of these environments will appeal to some students, other environments will appeal to others and so on. But certainly the notion of sort of graphical and graphical interfaces and things of that kind, I mean, that tends to be the kind of environment that most young people will tend to find attractive and find interesting. And certainly one of the things we need to do in computing education is to address this whole issue of the context in which students learn. And part of that is finding languages or environments that they find attractive, that they find appealing, that they want to explore, and so on and so forth. So Alice and Scratch and so on is part of it, but there's a general issue in there about setting the context in which students enjoy and will work and will explore and so on.
I see. So that kind of relates to this idea of a classroom culture or classroom environment, and Lucia Barker and her research with the National Center of Women in IT. What are your views on safety critical systems development?
Well, I think the whole area of safety critical systems development is a hard area. I think it is very hard. It's very technical. The difficulties in there stem from various considerations. I mean, it's not just about building software that needs to be perfect, whatever perfect means, but it's also necessary that, you know, the translation software, the compilers and so on, other supporting software such as operating systems, such as interfaces, including the hardware and the communications and so on, they all need to be perfect as well. If you try to focus on just one aspect of that, the danger is that you'll use other software that has got bugs in it, or software that causes your system to trip up in some sort of way. And one of the other difficulties with these safety critical systems is that they tend to be long life systems that are around maybe for 20 years or thereabouts. And of course we know that in the world of computing, then 20 years is a long time. In that time, you know, hardware will come and go, it will change. And because the hardware changes, then lots of the compilers and operating systems and so on have all got to change. And yet, if you're dealing with a safety critical system, then that safety critical system has got to continue to work and continue to work properly, even in the context of all that level of change. So it's difficult. Also, if you look at some of the mathematics associated with safety critical systems, then the mathematics provides certain insights, but there's always the danger of overextending the mathematics or overplaying it. And of course, safety critical systems just keep getting larger and larger and larger because the imagination of individuals, you know, shows no bounds, and people want to make bigger systems and better systems and so on. So it's a difficult area. Of course, an important approach to building up all these levels of safety and reliability, of course, is to use diverse systems and to have an element of redundancy that can then be utilized in the event of something going wrong or something going amiss. But understanding diversity is another area that is non-trivial. Different languages, different people, different systems, different hardware, different all sorts of things. And so a quick summary is it's a difficult area and not easy at all.
You know, Andrew, can you share your ideas around formal methods and software engineering?
Well, one of the problems with the word formal is that it's usually associated with mathematics. And, of course, it needn't be, but it tends to be associated with mathematics. And mathematics, certainly for younger people, is often not all that popular. In the computing context, of course, formalism is important. And it's important in the sense that it's often the key to automation, to building software and to automating something. So one of the challenges in computing education is conveying and demonstrating the benefits and attractions of formalism to students, and doing that in a way that doesn't drown them in the mathematics. And that, of course, is a challenge. Of course, there are huge benefits of formal methods in the context of software, and it's kind of interesting that, you know, when things are simple and easily understood from a formal point of view, then that tends to reflect just the good qualities that we want out of software, and reflects good design, often reflects elegance and so on. So there's an important role that formal methods have to play, but as I say, we don't want to drown students in mathematics.
What are the three most important broader computing challenges and their solutions?
Well, that's again interesting. Some time ago, some of us in the UK developed what we saw as educational grand challenges in computing, and in that group of challenges, there was a sort of mixture of the technical and the non-technical. So the first one that was identified was, of course, this public image of the discipline, and it's the public image in the eyes of students, in the eyes of parents, in the eyes of employers, and so on. Of course, regarding public images, well, an important dimension of that is offering challenges to bright young people. You want the bright young people to devote their lives in some sense to computing, and part of the image is actually to demonstrate that there are important, difficult challenges that they can spend their lives or aspire to tackling. The school situation, of course, is also part of that, and you know, in the schools there's lots of highly dedicated teachers, but very often you have a curriculum that is seen as dated and seen as unattractive. So to address the whole issue of public image, it's kind of important to have inspiring teachers and a modern curriculum. And we were talking earlier about the AP developments in the US, and there is great attention to addressing just this, trying to create a modern curriculum, trying to associate with that a group of teachers who are inspiring and who will take forward the teaching and the inspiration and so on. So it's a kind of important that that activity succeed. So public image was certainly one of the major issues that we identified as a challenge. We also identified programming and the teaching of programming as a challenge. That's been a problem for some time, and of course the technological development I mentioned earlier of multi-core, that has increased that challenge dramatically, so that it's increased it to the extent that we're not sure what the solutions are. So there are lots of folk trying to find solutions in there, but the teaching of programming, both just at the level of, you know, sequential programming, but programming at the level of dealing with multi-core, there are huge challenges in there. And then there's the formal methods that we spoke about earlier. They tend to be unpopular, and yet exposing students to a certain amount of, you know, formalisms is actually important. If you're wondering about how you try to solve that problem of the mathematics and the formalisms, well, solutions there seem to reside in the use of graphical tools and in the use of other support tools. So actually using software and software systems to help with the education in the area of mathematics seems to be a way forward. So those are the three: the public image, teaching and programming, and the formal or the mathematical.
Do you see some kind of governmental role in terms of the public image?
I think so. I think so. And I think that, you know, what's happening in the US just now is kind of important in that regard. You know, the very fact that there's a, you know, computing education week and so on, I think is important. But I think also there's a kind of recognition that computing is important, and, you know, part of that is stemming from some of the cybersecurity issues that exist and leading to questions about how we're going to deal with some of the cybersecurity issues and so on. So I do think it's important, but there's different governments. I see what's happening in the US, and I compare it to what's happening in in the UK, and I think that at level of government, a lot depends on the confidence that some of the individuals have in terms of making decisions and bringing about change that emphasises the importance of computing and so on. I think there's some very important issues in there, and I think there is an important role for government, but I think maybe government needs some level of support, maybe from the academic community, to discuss the way ahead and how to deal with it all.
You know, when you look at other professions, you know, you can take accounting and get a commerce degree and do audit cleaning, become a chartered accountant or equivalent in the different countries around the world. So there's sort of a tie-in between the educational system and then, you know, as a profession, whatever that profession is. It could be medicine, law, engineering, accounting, and so on. Do you see IT or this whole area of computing moving in that direction at all? Or, you know, what are your views on that?
Yes, well, I mean, there are some developments in that general area. If you take engineering, for example, then in the world of engineering, then there's a thing called the Washington Accord, which is an agreement about recognition of engineering degrees in different countries, such as in the US, in the UK, in Canada, in New Zealand, Australia, and so on and so forth. And basically what the Washington Accord ensures is that if degrees of the right standard come forward, then those degrees will be recognized in different countries, and that's kind of important. In the world of informatics, then, approximately a year ago, there was a new accord that was developed in Seoul in South Korea. So the Seoul Accord exists, and that again is about developing mutual understanding of undergraduate degrees in the UK, in the US, in South Korea, and in various other countries. And that again is important international and mutual recognition of qualifications. Of course, what you are talking about is really at the professional level, and again there are some developments that are about trying to look at qualifications of professionals and see mutual recognition between different countries. And this has been developed under IP3, and there are things happening there, but there are a relatively early stage of development, and it will be interesting to see how that goes. I think one of the issues there is that if you go back to the world of medicine, then of course you require a license to practice medicine, and that requirement for a license to practice doesn't really exist in many. It may exist in small pockets at the moment, but it's not something that is widespread, although that may change. So I think there are important developments happening, and it'll be interesting to see how things do develop. Part of the discussion about cybersecurity, for example, is, you know, should we only allow licensed folk to be involved in the programming of big systems? If you go back to the world of safety critical systems, one of the discussion points there is, should we only allow people who are licensed to be involved in working in those systems and so on? And while there are no answers there yet, there's plenty of discussion around those areas, and just perhaps the issue of licensing, the issue of certification and so on is something that, well, certainly there's an increased discussion about it, but we have to watch to see how that develops.
So I guess, I just had an interview this week with Joe Turner, who chairs the Seoul Accord, so it's kind of like a small world this week anyways. And doesn't Joe sit also on your education board or education council?
Yes, Joe Turner's a valuable member of our education council, and he comes and tells us about these developments involving the Seoul Accord and how things are moving ahead.
You know, I see you being this hub of this ecosystem worldwide where you're involved with so many different activities, professional societies, professional initiatives and education and much more. And because you're this hub of an ecosystem, I'm asking you to look in your crystal ball and provide your predictions of future computing trends and their implications and opportunities.
Well, I think, being involved in the various things, one thing plays off with the other. You know, when you're involved, let's say, with you know, the ACM Education Board or the ACM Education Council, then it's important to know what's happening at the level of the Solar Accord, or it's important to know what's happening in the context of Europe or other contexts and so on. And although it sounds as if there are lots of different things, actually lots of these things are kind of related and play off one another and indeed feed one to the other. And it means that you don't have sort of conflict situations developing, but rather you have things developing in a way that is harmonious and everyone understands and so on and so forth. So that's kind of important to say that. I mean, in terms of, you know, future computing trends and implications and opportunities and so on, then, you know, the technological trends are kind of clear that they relate to faster, cheaper, and so on. Part of that is, you know, increasing attention to mobility and all that that entails. And basically, the trends that I was talking about earlier in terms of hardware, increasing number of cores, then that's just leading to huge challenges in the world of software development. And of course, all of that has got a knock-on effect into the world of education, not just the world of education of students, but the world of education of software developers. And of course, when we were talking earlier there about licensing, I mean, one of the issues to do with licensing is just the whether licensing is something that's given as an, you get it once and that's you with it for life, or whether your license has got is time limited and lasts for, let's say, 5 years. And certainly in the UK, the British Computer Society is developing a professional award where it's time limited, that after 5 years you have to get relicensed and so on. And part of the relicensing process is to provide evidence or demonstrate that you've kept up to date and that you've kept up to date with technological developments or with business developments or whatever. And I think given the rate of change and given the importance of some of these areas, then that issue of if licensing is going to come about, then it's likely to be sort of time limited, and therefore that is going to lead to, you know, ongoing professional education and having to provide evidence that you've undertaken continuing professional education and so on. And of course, for most people who are working hard on a day-to-day basis and so on, then that education is likely to involve e-learning and online courses and so on. They seem to be the most popular ways by which busy professionals keep themselves up to date. So from all of that, you can pick out, you know, a number of things about thinking in terms of the way ahead, but education looks like being an important part of it, coupled with online courses and e-learning and so on.
So I guess really what you're saying then is continuing demonstrated professional development, which ensures that computing professionals are kept up to date and can demonstrate that they're up to date.
That's correct. I think the providing evidence is actually quite important. And of course that the provision of evidence creates challenges for, you know, those who are doing the licensing. But basically within, you know, the British Computer Society, people are struggling with that and looking at ways in which they can make it simpler. And part of that is, of course, a dialogue between industry and the society. It's about how best to do that. But I think there's a kind of determination around that, you know, having people licensed and licensed for a limited period of time and then asking them to re-demonstrate their capability or their competence, as it's called, is kind of important.
And something that you sort of mentioned earlier, in that there's quite a few, of initiatives worldwide in different areas of computing. And they're not conflicting, but they're complementary. I guess that's what you were trying to point out. So, you know, how can industry and academia work more effectively together?
Well, there's a lot that can be said about that. I mean, certainly, in many computing departments, what you'll find is that the departments have industrial advisory boards, and the industrial advisory boards are there to kind of offer advice and guidance as to, you know, how, what they want from graduates. And of course, the implications are that the courses should actually respond to the needs of industry. So certainly industry can offer advice and, you know, guidance to departments, or can offer reactions to the kind of developments that departments are pursuing. There's pitfalls in there, of course, because one of the problems for departments is that they need to get a balanced and representative perspective about what the needs of industry are. And of course, if you ask one or maybe even two individuals, you may well get views that push in a particular direction because someone has got an axe to grind. So there's issues there for universities and institutions about making sure they get a balanced and representative perspective. And of course, what that tends to mean is that you get a number of industrialists to come and to give advice and have them all present together so that the ideas bounce off one another. Also, another thing that's important about industry is that I was mentioning earlier the issue of the context in which computing is taught. And of course, industry can typically offer context which students find inspiring and motivating. So that takes you to the level of summer employment, internships of varying time frames, and so on. But also, if you think about, you know, NASA, if you think of Google, if you think of Microsoft, if you think of your favorite software supplier, then they often provide a context that appeals to students and they find interesting. And, you know, undertaking computing studies in a context where some of these organizations are, you know, providing some of the problems and so on, then students are likely to find that interesting, and that's important. Another aspect of this, of course, is that often in industry you will get really inspiring folk who can give lectures of amazing quality and so on. And, you know, therein lies an opportunity but also a threat. It tends to be a threat in the sense that if students listen to these inspiring folk, then they can actually undermine the teacher in the classroom, who all of a sudden looks less good than they were the previous day, sort of thing. So one way of trying to counter that and yet build on the benefits of the amazing lecturer is to develop relatively close partnerships between these amazing presenters and also, you know, teachers. The purpose being really to overcome that problem that I mentioned, but also to produce materials that then can be used in the classroom, that can be built on, that can be developed, that can, you know, make sure that the work of the inspirational lecturer is not confined just to the single lecture, but rather has a lifetime and an existence that is longer than that and reaps great benefits. Well, then, of course, you know, as soon as you talk about industry and academia, some folk will tend to, you know, raise the issue of resources and so on and money, but let's kind of avoid that and look at kind of deeper issues. One of the other ways in which academia can and industry can work together is that if industry is doing some, you know, amazing developments of some kind, then it'd be wonderful if good students had the opportunity to access the latest developments, to be involved in them in some sense. Again, from the point of view of, you know, inspiring the bright students to join and to see what's coming and to, you know, to remain in the business, to remain in the discipline and so on. That was a practice that was practiced, I think, a lot in Silicon Valley in years gone by, but it's something that is not practiced as much as it used to be, presumably because of commercial confidentiality reasons or something. But it provided great opportunities way back, and it would be nice to see that returning in a stronger way.
You know, what can we do to foster international cooperation, I should say, between disciplines and different types of bodies in order to achieve better benefits for society?
Well, I think one thing to say right away is that I think the international dimension of education is something that's very important. I think it's just vital that, you know, we understand one another, that we enjoy the rich diversity of our different cultures and so on. at the level of student mobility, for example, and on an international front, then within Europe, we've got an agreement that's called the Bologna Agreement, or Bologna Accord, and that's an intergovernment agreement that is to encourage the mobility of students and exchange of staff and so on. And that has resulted in Europe in a sort of wide-scale reappraisal of courses and course structures. And the purpose of that is really to ensure that some elements of comparability can occur, comparability between degrees, between backgrounds of students and so on. And associated with that, there are quality checks on the programs that are on offer. So the full force of that has still to hit. I mean, it's planned that the Bologna arrangements come into place in 2010, but it's a step in the right direction, and the intention is that, especially after a first degree, then, because of this comparability, then students will be able to move from one country to the other in order to undertake master's degrees and so on. Within the computer societies in various countries, then, there's certainly attention to the mutual recognition and understanding. We've spoken a bit about the Washington Accord, we've spoken about the Seoul Accord, and also about the development of those accords as an underpinning for professional qualifications that will facilitate mobility and so on. Certainly in the ACM, we see ourselves as an international organization. I mentioned that earlier, involving folk from other countries, and that international dimension is a really rich source of input and a rich source of resource. But perhaps the question you asked was really about, you know, computing societies and, let's say, mathematics societies or biology societies. And of course, that's a different ball game altogether, and is something that is difficult. Certainly, when we've been talking within the ACM about curricular developments, the notion of computing plus X, where X is another discipline, is something that was spoken about a lot. And of course, in that context, that we spoke about it earlier, the notion of computational thinking is something that has cropped up a lot. The kind of thinking that comes out of computing and then can be applied in the context of X. And part of the discussion there is, you know, is computational thinking for an arts graduate the same as computational thinking for an engineering graduate or for a mathematics graduate and so on? And all of that, to some extent, is in the melting pot. And again, to reiterate something we were talking about earlier, I would just say that all the energies in the directions of computational thinking and its role and so on are kind of bottled up at the moment within the developments of that new AP course, the Advanced Placement course, the course for schools that I was talking about. But I mean, the question about interdisciplinarity is very important. It's an important, and it's a fertile landscape, and it's something that we need to pay attention to.
You know, can you talk more about the key initiatives in your role as chair of the ACM Education Board and Council and what you hope to achieve?
Well, the way in which the Education Board and the Education Council work together is that essentially the Education Board manages the work of the Council, and essentially what I would like to see is, you know, the Education Council being the place where it all happens, where, you know, major developments and so on come before the Council. People become, get informed and so on. So from the perspective of ACM, and if you think of the work of the Council, what we need to do within the ACM is really to harness the enormous resources that exist within the ACM and apply them in such a way that they bring about a resolution of some of the problems we have within the computing education community. That's something we need to work on, and something that we need to do better, although we're making good progress in that area. Over the last year, the Education Board undertook an initiative with NSF, that's the US National Science Foundation, and essentially we held a summit of professional computing societies in the US that was held in Washington in June of this year. And the intention there was to see if there was some scope for sharing ideas about the various problems, about the various concerns we all had, and to see if we could then focus on ways in which these concerns could be addressed in a coordinated fashion, in a fashion that wouldn't lead to conflict or overlap, but would mean that we didn't stand on one another's toes. So that summit has happened. The report is due to be published very soon, and I mean within days. It's been published by the ACM. Of course, that summit needs to have long-term benefits regarding cooperation between the societies, and that's our hope and expectation. And we have conference calls coming up in the next day or two, which are about trying to push that forward and make sure that we get benefit out of all of that. Also, within the ACM Education Board and the Education Council, it's important that we offer support to the high schools and to the college sector. That group that are coming out of the high schools must come through with positive views about computing. Otherwise, they're not going to select computing or informatics as where they want to spend their lives and so on. So it's desperately important that we get this high school computing thing right. So part of what the members of the computing board and council are doing is their individuals are working in particular ways to help support that advanced placement activity to make sure that we get it right. But that is kind of a work in progress. But I mean, more generally, at the level of the Education Board and Education Council, we need to continue to work to try and improve the status of computing education and to encourage whatever way we can positive initiatives and positive developments. And we need to take a leadership role to make sure things happen.
I'm just wondering if, I'm not sure if you're able to do this or not, but you held a summit or a meeting of your Ed Council in September, and if you can just maybe discuss some of the stakeholders who were present or just indicate the kind of reach and the fact that you are trying to gauge all the different kinds of elements. I'm not sure if you can share that or not.
I'm happy to do it as well as my memory allows me to be honest. I mean, at that meeting in Vancouver, that was a meeting of the Education Council, and part of the discussion there was about the summit that happened in Washington. And what we tried to do at the council meeting was to get agreement about, you know, various outputs from that summit and so on. And so we invited a number of people from the Computer Society, from NCWIT, from Intel, from a number of the organizations who were all present at the summit. We invited them to the meeting of the council and in a quite open kind of way just, you know, discussed what the priorities were, what the ways ahead were, and how we should make progress and so on. So I thought there was a lot happened at that meeting, and there was a lot of exchange of views, and everyone was really singing from the same hymn sheet by the end of it all. Not that they were not singing from the same hymn sheet at the start. I mean, I think a lot of ideas were developed there, and it was useful. Part of the input there was from ACM's Education Policy Group, which is a group that operates in Washington, and listening to the work of the policy group was kind of important to make sure there wasn't overlap between what they were doing and the outputs of the US summit.
So at the council meeting, were high schools represented in terms of their computing science programs and two-year college programs, and then also the different regions of the world, were they represented?
Yes, that's right. At the meeting, we certainly the two representatives of the two-year colleges are part of the council. The person who's pushing forward with the AP developments is Jan Cuney, and she was present and she made a presentation about what was happening there and so on, and part of the discussion there led to a small group that would support her in terms of the way ahead. Quite a number of members of the Education Council that were there are deeply involved in the AP developments at various levels, and they were all present, so it was quite an informed kind of discussion we had, but at that stage, a lot of the details were still being discussed, and the details weren't available to us at that stage, just because they weren't available to anyone, that things were being worked on. At that council meeting, we also held an international panel, and the international panel was to try and get a better feel for international development. So we had the Director of Education from the Brazilian Computer Society. She was present, and she gave a presentation about computing education in South America, and it was interesting to compare what was happening in South America with what's happening in Europe. There was also representation from the Middle East. There was representation from India. And although there wasn't someone present from China then, the person from China had made his views known to some of the people who were going to be present there. And so there was discussion about what was happening in China. So that was all part of this business of the international profile and trying to make sure that the ACM takes an international perspective on things. And of course, it's all very well holding these meetings on an international basis, but part of the issue there is, you know, how do we move forward? And since Vancouver, the Director of Education from the Brazilian Computer Society has now moved on to the Education Council she's agreed to join. In terms of India, then there's a recognition that in India they will need something like an education board or an education council, and what we will aim to do is to work in collaboration with them about how we support them in terms of developing computing education there. And again, in the context of China, since that meeting in Vancouver, I've had dialogues with people from China, and they're anxious to work closely again with the Education Board and the Education Council to try and push things ahead. In terms of the Middle East that I referred to, then the Education Board is likely to pay a visit to the Middle East and hold one of its meetings there, the intention being to listen to and understand more fully some of the issues in the Middle East, to, of course, promote some of our own ideas across there, to set up ACM chapters at the level of either professional chapters or student chapters within the Middle East and so on. So although the meeting in Vancouver was really just about presentations, then, as I said, it's important to develop those sort of things and to take them forward and to make sure that they have meaning associated with them. And I think in each of the cases then that has happened.
And again, you know, you're serving as this facilitator, as the chair of both the Education Board and Council. So again, I commend you on that work. Because it's very important work.
Thank you. Thank you.
What are the other roles that you wish to fulfill in your goals?
Well, I think I'm kind of running out of ideas. But let me just mention a couple of things. I mean, I think this whole business of the schools computing that I was referring to earlier is just terribly important and needs support, and it's an area where if we don't make progress, then, you know, students are not going to come forward into computing, and that is a problem not only for, you know, higher education but for industry and the future and so on. So we cannot afford to have a bottleneck there at the school, and therefore that issue of schools computing has just got to succeed. And of course, although we've mentioned the AP developments in the US, then it's a problem in many countries as well. And often, you know, the policymakers in various countries are uncomfortable about supporting change. And of course, that tends to be a matter of confidence, or rather a lack of it. And somehow or other, we need to be able to support them in decision making. And even that is a challenge. So certainly in Scotland, one of the things I've been trying to do is to make progress there, but finding it difficult. And it's a problem in England also, and in other parts of the UK. On another front, one of the things I do is I act as an editor of computing textbooks, and I like to see, textbooks as a great rich resource and a resource of, books that hopefully can inspire and bring about change and so on. So it's just one of the other areas that I spend my time in. So I think those were the only two roles. The only other role I have is that, I tend to be very active in family life and so on, and that keeps me pretty busy also.
You know, I like to now mine your long history of many successes and contributions and really marking historical inflection points many times throughout your career. So from that sort of rich experience, what lessons do you wish to pass on to the audience?
Well, let me mention five of them. I think it's important, for younger people that when you're younger that you develop yourself to your maximum potential and take good opportunities when they come your way. I think that's quite important. I mean, as you get older and as you move towards family life and so on, your priorities change and the opportunities for doing deep and sustained thinking about technical issues and other issues are actually reduced and often reduced considerably. So I think for young people, it's actually quite important to take the opportunities they have at the time when they, they go to university or college and develop themselves and to their maximum potential. So that's one thing. Second thing I would say is that if you're in the world of, computing education, then it's important to try to convey the passion and elegance of your discipline. And really to try to strive to get students to produce work that they're proud of and that they find meaningful. And I think it's important not to forget bright students. I think often the tension is to students who are in danger of failing and so on. And of course those students are important and have got to be looked after. But bright students will also be looked after and have also got to achieve their maximum potential. So that's the second one. I think in the world of computing education, then the heart of computing education is what is taught and about how it is taught and about getting students to excel. And the reason I mention that is that much of the world of education is tied up with bureaucracy. And I see an awful lot of people spending enormous amounts of time in bureaucracy and, categorizing it as computing education. So I would just like to caution the whole issue of being able to be sure to distinguish between what is and what is really important from your perspective. Is it computing education you're doing or is it the bureaucratic side of things? Fourth one is I think it's important to develop the right kind of network. I think that's important for everyone at the level of students, at the level of professional level and so on. And I think developing the right kind of networks is about, creating the right kind of environment or the right kind of context in which to operate. And I think it's appropriate that for everyone, they never feel isolated. And I say that for, people who are heads of departments as well as students. I think being isolated is something that you should never be, and developing the right kind of networks, the right kind of support infrastructure is important. I also think it's important to listen to others and to consult. But of course, consultation can go on forever, and therefore, putting a time limit on it is kind of important. The last one is that if you're dealing with quality in any sense, and that can mean dealing, choosing people, that can mean looking at courses, that can mean all sorts of things, then I think it's important to seek evidence of that quality. And of course, in that whole area, then it's important to remember that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So those are the five areas. One is about when you're younger. The second is about trying to convey the passion and elegance. The third is just distinguishing between computing education and bureaucracy. The fourth is about networks and not being isolated. And the fifth is when you're talking about quality, making sure you've got evidence.
What are your top recommended resources and why?
Well, I guess the top resource has got to be, you know, other people. Other people have got different thoughts, have got different experiences and so on. Other institutions do things differently. Sometimes they do them better, sometimes they do them worse. But that diversity of experience and thoughts and so on is really a rich source of information and a source of evidence. And it's a way to learn, and I think it's an important way to learn. When I was, you know, head of department, for instance, I mean, certainly one of the things you worry about as a head of department is, you know, is this the only way in which you can run a department? Is there any other way of running it and so on? And through the whole process of quality assessment of other universities by going round and looking at them, then you look at other institutions and you see the way they do things and you learn from them as to what's a good way of doing things and what's a not so good way of doing things. And so that issue of other people, other thoughts, other experience, other institutions is quite important. Certainly, of course, as another resource, the internet and digital libraries and all that goes with that is clearly a rich source of information and just information available anytime, anywhere and so on. I think computer societies are also a very rich source of information, certainly through the Computing Board and the Education Board and Education Council. Then I've learned a lot through contacts with other people. Through these organizations also you tend to have computing conferences and meetings and journals and magazines and so on, and all of those are a rich source of information as well. So those would tend to be the three that I would identify, first being people, second being internet, third being societies and so on.
So I take it you would then encourage people to take time to join societies and to make their contributions so they can have impact and you know, their ideas can be reflected on a broader scale, perhaps.
Yes, I think that's right. And part of that is what I was saying earlier about, you know, networks. That, you know, for many people, they want to find, you know, people who have got similar interests and who have got similar problems and so on. And often through computing societies, you will find colleagues who are working in a similar area or who have got similar problems, who, you know, have got similar needs in terms of how they want to be educated, what they want to find more about, and so on. So you want to, you know, you can often do that through computer societies and by joining interest groups and, you know, finding colleagues who have similar interests and they provide you with support and often help and guidance and so on.
Yeah, Andrew, you've taken us on a remarkable journey through your very rich experiences, your, you know, deep knowledge and insights. And I'm thinking that, you know, we're down to probably the last two questions here. You know, do you have some stories that you can share from your work?
Well, I think maybe there's three that I can identify, and maybe these fall into the category of, you know, something surprising or something unexpected, and maybe even something humorous. But in terms of involvement with computing education, I think one of the things I would comment on is that many of the very top universities take a very healthy view of the real importance and the of education, and they offer excellent education to their students. And I've been thoroughly impressed by, you know, the dedication of many of their staff, by the level of commitment, by the education that they give to students, by their approach to experimenting with a view to getting evidence that will support change, and the way in which they involve. They evolve the curriculum and so on. It's just great. But in contrast, you know, in many parts of academia, there's a sort of real tension that exists between research and education. And that tension shouldn't really be present. In many institutions, what you get is promotion often on the basis of just research and research only. And many who are involved with students and so on suffer over that, and I think that's an area of concern. I think it's changing a little bit, but there's room for things being better in that area. And that comment is perhaps a comment that applies more in some countries rather than others, maybe more in the UK than elsewhere, but is a comment that I think should be made. A second comment I would make is that, you know, for students, for every one of them, it's kind of important that they have the right environment in which to study. And, you know, one of the things that means is that they've got to be comfortable within that environment. They've got to enjoy the work. They've got to feel engaged. They've got to feel motivated. They've got to feel that if they get a good degree, then they're going to be proud of it and so on. And on occasion, that means for some students that they should go to the top research institutions, and that is fine. In other cases, it may mean that for a particular student, then there's an institution where they will maybe receive more care, they will receive more personal attention, they will receive more intubation, they will receive more contact with the academic staff and so on. And yet other cases, it might mean that there's closeness to some academic sector, communication sector or software development or something in that case. And it's often true that, you know, counsellors and parents and advisors don't recognise that and are more concerned about all sorts of other considerations about reputation and so on. Often as an advisor or as a parent, it means that you've got to advise a student not to stay at a particular institution, but to change institution and to go elsewhere. And sometimes that can seem strange or disloyal to a colleague, but actually, from the point of view of a student, it's the right kind of advice that you need to offer. And certainly several times throughout my career, I've had to take that step of saying to a student, look, you're in the wrong institution, you ought to move, and then offering them advice as to what the right kind of institution is for them. And I think there's something that's kind of important in there and something that's important for every individual student. If we want to, you know, address something that is humorous and so on, then that's a little bit more difficult. I'll tell you two stories here. One is I find humorous, but on the other hand, I'm aware that Scottish humour is Scottish and maybe doesn't travel too well, so I'm a bit anxious about telling you the first one. But anyway, the first one was a student we had a while back. His first name was Liam, L-I-A-M, and his surname was Malone, as in Bugsy Malone, and folk wondered why he failed a group work project. So that's the first story, and I'll leave you to think about that. On a slightly more serious note, I've often heard of people talking about, you know, computing should be fun. And of course, that's correct in the sense that it must be enjoyable. But in some countries and in some cultures, the word fun is interpreted to include an element of frivolity, of being frivolous and so on. So I've also heard the statement that computing education should not be fun. And of course, the issue in there is just about the interpretation that one places on the word fun.
We're down to our last question here. So, and I kind of turned tables here. Now, we covered a lot of areas, but, you know, if you were doing the interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Yes, that's difficult. So the first question is a question that I would often ask at an interview and or a variant of it and so on. So the question would be as follows. If you were given, let's say, $10 million for use in computing education, then how would you use it? So that's the question. So the answer to that would be something along the lines of, well, there's an awful lot of work that needs to be done to understand how to teach informatics properly. And here I'm thinking of the view that I was advocating earlier. So I'd be thinking of, you know, channeling some of the money in that kind of direction. So it would be in the direction of supporting young people to undertake research that would lead to them becoming inspired teachers of computing and ambassadors for the right kind of way in which computing should be taught. I would also use some of the money to be enlisting the help of industry along the lines that I was describing earlier. the notion that industry provides a context in which we can use to inspire young people. And also there's this notion of getting the inspiring lecturers who can provide materials that would again be used in the classroom in a sensible kind of way. So that would be my answer to number one. The next question is this issue about, you know, how do you think that the kind of conflict between the research and teaching should be addressed or reconciled and so on. And my answer to that is really about, you know, trying to get recognition for the importance of informatics education research to make sure that it gets a reputation for being important and also being hard. In many ways, it's got to be shown to be worthy of comparison with more traditional views of research. And, you know, the emergence of the right kind of journals of this issue of the status of computing educators and so on, all of that is becoming rather important, and seeing these journals as the right kinds of vehicles for publication and for good quality papers and so on is kind of important. One of the third question would really be along the lines of that with curricula generally, then curricula tend to be overloaded. And so inserting something new into, let's say, the high school curriculum can be problematic. And so the question there is, why should computing or informatics education be allowed to elbow its way in and therefore presumably elbow something out? And my answer to that would be that, of course, I don't believe it should be elbowing its way in at all. I believe that it should be welcomed with open arms. If you take the view that informatics education is about increasing or enhancing the capacity and the capability of an individual, then expertise in that, of course, is going to mean that students are generally far more effective as learners and therefore will be better able to benefit from their studies in other disciplines. Related to this, I've heard the saying that a computer is a lens through which you can view other disciplines, and I think that's a really powerful observation. Second part of the answer to that question is to draw attention to the whole issue of global competition, to the need to innovate, the need to generate wealth, and so on. And of course, our educational systems are of vital importance here, and you know, enhancing the capability and the capacity of individuals is a vital aspect of all of that. So, allied to that, I would just observe that, you know, computing or informatics itself provides a context in which the barriers to innovation are less than they are in other areas. And so teaching innovation in the context of computing has got to have considerable attractions. But above all, there's this issue of enhancing the capability and the capacity of the individual and seeing them as better placed to survive in the world of the future.
Well, you know, you've taken us on this remarkable journey and sharing your insights, your stories, your experiences, and all the contributions you make. And, you know, we very much appreciate this and we very much respect you for all of the work you do. So, you know, Andrew, we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions, and we deeply thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I've enjoyed it very much, and thank you for asking me.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Andrew McGettrick, preeminent educator and scientist.